Well, good evening. Thank you for coming. We are looking at Micah chapter 5 this evening. We're going to get through verses 1 through 5. We'll probably read through the whole chapter to start it off and take a look at what's going on. What we're looking at is the time of probably 720 B.C. Up until 701 B.C. This is the time the Assyrians were coming in. Assyria defeated northern Israel. And then Judah in the south began to make a treaty with Assyria, began to work with them. Assyria invaded the land and was sweeping through Judah during the years 703, 702, and actually approached the walls of Jerusalem in 701, and spoke with Hezekiah. Sennacherib, the Assyrian king, records Hezekiah's name, talks about what he had done to him, as far as keeping him locked up in Jerusalem like a bird in a cage, building up siege works against his walls, kind of giving a little more impression that he got a little closer to Jerusalem and dealt a little more personally with Hezekiah than the text would indicate. But this is talking about the Assyrians at this time. Along with that, we can decide what these verses are talking about. Micah is prophesying about these events, warning the people of the coming disaster. Where he's writing at during this time period, we're not sure. But he also talks about the future. And the future is a distant future. I don't think it's the future talking about the return of the exiles from Babylon, although that was a type of the return. He's talking about a future where the Messiah is going to come up and be king. So there's two things happening here. This is the time of disaster, the time of judgment, the time of exile, the time that Jerusalem is going to suffer, the time that they've got bad leadership, their kings are weak, overrun by the nations. But there's always going to be a promise of a future of when they will find the Lord, they will have a strong king, a God-like king, the Messiah, who will then defeat the enemies and also set up a kingdom and rule over the world. And so what we see in these verses is a continuation of that theme, chapter 5. I'm going to read all of chapter 5, and you can hear this very thing. Some contemporary information about the Assyrians, promise of a great day in the future, and then a return to the days of the Assyrians coming. And I think we should understand the Assyrians of being during this time period, because Mike is living right in the midst of these kings of the Assyrians coming and conquering Israel in the north, Sennacherib coming down. These are his days, along with guys like Isaiah. So chapter 5, verse 1. Marshal your troops, O city of troops, for a siege is laid against us. They will strike Israel's ruler on the cheek with a rod. Okay, that's the negative, kind of building even on what's gone before. But now comes the positive. But you, Bethlehem Ephrathah, though you are small among the clans of Judah, out of you will come for me one who will be ruler over Israel, whose origins are from of old, from ancient times. Therefore, because this ruler is coming, therefore, Israel will be abandoned until the time when she who is in labor gives birth. Again, talking about the time of abandonment, but it's going to be ended when this Messiah comes. And the rest of his brothers return to join the Israelites. He will stand and shepherd his flock in the strength of the Lord, in the majesty of the name of the Lord his God, and they will live securely, for then his greatness will reach to the ends of the earth, and he will be their peace. Again, noticing there, a ruler in Israel, establishing Israel, but then ruling all through the ends of the earth. Now, verse 5. Now, again, notice verse 5, you're in the middle of verse 5, and he will be their peace. That's the first part of verse 5. But a whole another subject begins at the next phrase. When the Assyrian invades our land and marches through our fortresses, we will rise against him 7 shepherds, even 8 leaders of men. They will rule the land of Assyria with the sword, the land of Nimrod with drawn sword. He'll deliver us from the Assyrian when he invades our land and marches into our borders. The remnant of Jacob will be in the midst of many peoples, like dew from the Lord, like showers on the grass which do not wait for man or linger for mankind. The remnant of Jacob will be among the nations in the midst of many peoples, like a lion among the beasts of the forest, like a young lion among flocks of sheep, which mauls and mangles as it goes, and no one can rescue. Your hand will be lifted up in triumph over your enemies, and all your foes will be destroyed. In that day, declares the Lord, I will destroy your horses from among you, and demolish your chariots, and will destroy the cities of your land, and tear down all your strongholds. I will destroy your witchcraft, and you will no longer cast spells. I will destroy your carved images and your sacred stones from among you. You will no longer bow down to the work of your hands. I will uproot from among you your Asherah poles, or Asherah poles, and demolish your cities. I will take vengeance in anger and wrath upon the nations that have not obeyed me. And we'll get into those verses next week, but tonight we're looking at verses 1 through 5. On your notes, two simple pages. You've got the English Standard Version, and that negative verse that starts this off, chapter 5, verse 1. Now muster your troops, O daughter of troops. Siege is laid against us. With a rod they strike the judge of Israel on the cheek. Now do notice, this is Micah talking. Apparently, at some point the Lord is going to be speaking in this also. But he's associating himself with the people. Now muster your troops, O daughter of troops. Siege is laid against us. And so Micah would be with these people. I'm going to say this is something Micah is going to see. Micah is going to be prophesying this event, and it's going to be the city of Jerusalem. It could go positive at first, you know, when you first read it, you know, daughter of troops, you know, all right, you know, muster your troops, you're going to stand up and fight. Siege is laid against us. Now, what's going to happen? You got this battle. The siege is coming. That would be Sennacherib. If we allow this to be 701 BC, if he's prophesying of this event of the Assyrians, and I think we got to consider that because it's his time period. But there's sieges laid against Jerusalem. The daughter of troops would be Jerusalem. The daughter would be, she's a she. The city is a she. Daughter of troops, that would be where the military's at. The troops are in the city. And so the daughter of troops would be the city of troops, or the city where the military's stationed. And so the troops are there. They're to be mustered because they're having siege laid against them. So what's going to be the result? Well, here's the result. With a rod, they strike the judge of Israel on the cheek. Okay, so it didn't go so well. I mean, if you've got the people outside the city walls, your troops are ready to fight, what's the result? Well, they hit the king in the face with a rod. That's what happened. That means the troops didn't fare very well. So that's the negative side of this. And point two on that, it says daughter of troops is the literal Hebrew, daughter of troops. It is a phrase referring to Jerusalem and the troops that are stationed in the city. Now, this could be a warning of judgment against the city of Micah's day, I write right here, that treated the common people or the middle class of Jerusalem in warlike fashion. The social crimes that the leadership of Jerusalem with the troops, the leadership that had the troops, they've been treating the people of Jerusalem in a military fashion. In fact, I've got the references right there, Micah 2:8, 3:2, 3:9, 7:2. The social crimes of Israel, the social crimes of Jerusalem, are described as warlike. They're described in war fashion. So these troops of the city of Jerusalem have been troops that have been laying siege against their own people, ruling as if they're at war with the people. And that's what the whole book of Micah is about. Same way with Amos, is the people are oppressed. The government is treating them in a military fashion, in a tyranny, if you would. And so the result is going to be, guess what? Your troops, you're going to actually face a real war. You're going to actually not just have to oppress the middle class and be warlike with your citizens. You're going to have to face the Assyrians. A real war is coming to your walls. Thus the leaders, point B, thus the leaders who ruled their own people like warlords or troops will now have to face a real military battle and invasion from Assyria. And that's exactly what's going to happen in 701. And it's going to sweep through the land of Judah. All the strongholds will fall, and Assyrians will come up to the walls of the city of Jerusalem. Now, it says, with a rod they strike the judge of Israel. The word judge, I've got that point three, is the word sopet, translated ruler in the NIV. And this should be understood as the king. And the word is sopet, and this is important in just a moment. Sopet is like, why didn't we use the word king, malak, or something like this that refers to king? Why sopet? Well, if you drop down to point four, the word rod is the Hebrew word sabet. So what you have in the Hebrew, I'm not a Hebrew scholar or a Hebrew expert, don't even know the Hebrew letters, but the word would be pronounced sabet and sopet. So they're going to strike the sopet against the sopet. Sobet against the sobet. Sobet against the sopet. And so there is a play on words right there in the Hebrew that Mike, and that may be why he chose a word that could be translated judge. It could be translated ruler. It could be translated king. It's the leader of the people. The leader is going to be struck by the Assyrians with a sabet. And so, again, we could think of maybe a better word if you're talking about the king. But if you're trying to be sarcastic on what's the result, well, Sopet gets hit with Sabet by the Assyrians on the invasion. After you've mustered your troops to fight against the siege, this is the result. In the discussion of the rod, I've got these things pointed out. And again, striking the king on the cheek indicated total defeat of the culture and the king's troops. I think we maybe need to consider, if nothing else, if this is a real thing that happened. It happened throughout history at different places, different times. But if we're talking about Hezekiah, it doesn't record this event taking place. But we do know, as I've got written down here, point A, Sennacherib's Assyrian records, and I saw the scroll or the prisms, got pictures of them, I showed them to you. Sennacherib's Assyrian records record his treatment of Hezekiah as this. He writes, I shut him up like a bird in a cage. I surrounded him with an earthwork, meaning siege works around the city. He taxed him heavily. Hezekiah had to take gold and send it up to Assyria. And so if it wasn't a physical striking in the face, and if it is Hezekiah, nonetheless, the Assyrians did take Hezekiah, and he was a vassal of the Assyrians, partly willingly because of the position he'd been put in by his father, Ahaz, but also because of the situation, the result of the war. Hezekiah just stayed in the city and watched his land get run over. All of his fortresses, all of his strongholds in Judah were taken, and Hezekiah was in this position. So Micah is telling the people that your king is going to be struck with a rod by the Assyrians. And if it's physical, that's a discussion we don't know about yet. But we do know, as far as the result of the war, Hezekiah didn't have much left. Now, with that being said, if you do look at the last verse of chapter 3, I'm looking at it right here in my Bible, where it says, Zion will be plowed, chapter 3, verse 12, Zion will be plowed like a field. Jerusalem will become a heap of rubble. The temple will hill a mound overgrown with thickets. We know from the book of Jeremiah that Hezekiah heard Micah say this, speak this, and responded to it. Now, if he personally heard it or got a recording of it as far as a document, the book of Jeremiah says that Hezekiah responded to those words. It would also be assumed that he would have heard this prediction too, that the sopet will be struck with a sabet by the Assyrians when they come. And so he was in a repentance mode. He was trying to seek the Lord in this. This word did get to Hezekiah. Now, if he actually got hit with a rod by the Assyrians, can't answer that. But as far as him being oppressed by the Assyrians, that was something that took place. It is interesting in point 3b, Isaiah speaks of the Assyrians coming with a rod in Isaiah 10:24. And now realize, again, don't take your eye off this. Micah and Isaiah are talking and speaking at the same time. We know that Micah's word was heard by Hezekiah because the book of Jeremiah, the elders talk about Micah, his word, affecting Hezekiah. We know from the book of Isaiah that Hezekiah and Isaiah were in constant communication. We know from Chronicles and Kings, the book of Kings and Chronicles records, that Isaiah and Hezekiah were in constant contact with each other. So when Isaiah talks about the rod of the Assyrians, Hezekiah would have heard of that coming. Micah says the same thing. Again, as you know, they have found bule, things that were sealed, clay that was sealed with the signet ring of Hezekiah, and a seal or a bule was a bula was found with the prophet Isaiah's seal in it, and one of these bula were found just a few feet apart, like from here to that wall, apart from each other, where a bunch of scrolls apparently had been thrown over the wall or destroyed. And the only thing that remained were the seal that was on the documents. And so the Bible talks about these people being in contact with each other. We found seals, their own seals, close to each other. So Isaiah was talking to Hezekiah, and Hezekiah was talking to Isaiah. They were writing each other documents, letters, correspondence, emails. And so it's just interesting to hear Micah talk about the rod, and now In Isaiah, it says, Isaiah 10:24, therefore, this is what the Lord, the Almighty Lord says, my people who live in Zion, do not be afraid of the Assyrians who beat you with a rod and lift up a club against you as Egypt did. Now, again, Isaiah also talks about the rod in 14:29 concerning the Philistines. And in chapter 30, verse 31 of Isaiah, the Lord is going to use his own rod against the Assyrians. In his retaliation. This leads into just a comment and something to be looking for, and you probably heard something about this before, but there is the Assyrian of this day, of this book, which would be Sennacherib or Sargon or Tiglath-Pileser, you know, Sennacherib in Hezekiah's day. That's the Assyrian, but all these verses are going to then not just talk about 700s B.C., but they're also going to be talking about some future. When the Lord returns, the Lord is going to have to fight against the enemy. He's going to have to fight against the nations. And the Assyrians, the historical Assyrians, become a type or a shadow of the enemy that the Lord himself will face, which would then be the Antichrist and the Antichrist kingdom, if you want to call it, you know, Babylon the Great or the Antichrist. And so whenever a lot of times these verses about the Assyrian, and it's another word for Antichrist. Now, again, be careful with that because some of these are very specific references to events in 700 B.C. But at the same time, some of them bleed over, just like you've got the king in chapter 5, verse 1, being struck with a rod. You're going to have the future king using a rod to strike the Assyrians. This is Hezekiah, and this is the Messiah. And so there, it's two sides. In fact, that's the play you've got going on here in chapter 5. You've got in chapter 5, verse 1, the king getting struck with a rod. But as soon as you get to chapter 5, verse 2, don't worry about it because there's a king coming that's not going to get struck with a rod. He's going to be the one doing the striking. And so you've got the king of 700s, compared to the king of the future. Likewise, you've got the Assyrians of the 700s compared to the Assyrians, which would include the Antichrist, in the days that that Messiah would come. So sometimes when it talks about the Assyrian, you're talking about prophetically the Antichrist. We're not talking about, I'm not going there tonight. I'm just saying that keep your eyes open when it talks about the Assyrian. If it's historical, like I think we're talking about here, it's taken care of, but there's going to be an Assyrian that's going to arise. Now, if he's coming from that area, we like to think of him, the Antichrist coming out of Syria, coming out of somewhere in the Persian area, Iran. That all matches with the biblical prophecies. But again, Daniel talks about the Antichrist coming from those who destroyed Jerusalem in those prophecies. He will come and destroy the city, and that's talking about that'd be one of the Roman legions in the area of Syria. And it all kind of fits, it's all the same area kind of point to. Again, we're not talking about that tonight, but just keep that in mind as we go through this. So anyway, that's talking about that first verse. Point five, it says this opening statement is a statement of doom for Jerusalem from the 700s. They did repent and lasted until 586, but they did suffer the Assyrians. And maybe part of the reason Hezekiah responded, Micah's response. Okay, now chapter 5, verse 2. Just as surely as we're talking negative in chapter 5, verse 1 about in the 700s, we're going to quickly swing up to the future when there's going to be a day of glory. There's going to be a day of victory. And this is something you see throughout Micah, that back and forth, that contrast. Okay, chapter 5, verse 2, we're looking on the notes on page 1. But you, O Bethlehem Ephrathah, who are too little to be among the clans of Judah, from you shall come forth for me, an important phrase, for me, one who is to be ruler in Israel. Just like we struck the ruler above or the judge above, now in verse 2, we've got a ruler coming for the Lord, for God, who will be ruler in Israel, whose coming forth is from of old, from ancient days. So this is got two things on this. Or we can say this. This is Micah talking in his day. We're going to just write 720 as a general date. Micah's writing, but he's talking about the future. He's talking about the distant future when this Messiah, that I'll just write that. He hasn't said Messiah yet, but that's what we're talking about, is going to come. But he's also talking about where he's coming from, the past. So we've got the present in Micah's day. That's where he's sandwiched in between. He's got talking about the future, but this Messiah who's coming is really not coming from here, not coming just in the future. He's going to appear here, but he's way back here before Micah's time. And we'll look at that. Point one, here's a statement of hope following the statement of doom in verse one. There is a coming king who will be noteworthy and not like the present government. And that's what the contrast for the people of Micah's day. He's contrasting their corrupt, worthless government, corrupt, worthless king who's going to be overrun by the Assyrians to a king who will not be overrun. A king, we saw it before, these people were unjust. This king will be just. This king will be oppressive. This king will be setting the people free. And that's the constant contrast throughout Micah. Point three on there. Ephrathah is an ancient name of Bethlehem. In fact, I've got three verses written down there. Listen to this. I'm going to say it again. Ephrathah is another name for Bethlehem. And it was used then later to identify different Bethlehems. There's this Bethlehem in Zebulun. There's this Bethlehem, Ephrathah, or the Old Testament. Here, for example, Genesis 35, 16 and 19. Then they moved on from Bethel. And you know this, just real quick map, since we got a little. This is from Genesis, Galilee, Jordan, Dead Sea here. You've got Jerusalem. You're going to have Bethel up in here. Bethlehem is going to be right here. Ephrathah, or Bethlehem. This is Bethel. And so Jacob is, it says right here, then they moved on from Bethel. They're moving from Bethel, and they're going to take the road right, going down towards Ephrathah. While there's still some distance from Ephrathah, Rachel began to give birth and had great difficulty. So Rachel died and was buried on the way to Ephrathah, that is Bethlehem. So Ephrathah, that is what? Bethlehem. So somewhere in here, they're on their way, but before they could get to Bethlehem, somewhere in here is where Rachel died. Now Jacob's going to repeat that in Genesis 48. As I was returning from Padan, Padan is Syria, up by where he stayed with his uncle Laban, brought his wife back. He was on his way back from Padan. To my sorrow, Rachel died in the land of Canaan, the promised land, while we were still on the way, a little distance from Ephrath. So I buried her there beside the road to Ephrath, that is Bethlehem. So it's somewhere on this road between Bethel and Ephrath. You got to be thinking you're getting close to it. They're on their way. Rachel died, and that's where she was buried. Now, Ruth, a different story. Ruth 4:11. This is the blessing for the family. Then the elders and all the people, speaking to Boaz at the gate, said, "We are witnesses. May the Lord make the woman who is coming into your home like Rachel and Leah, who together built up the family of Israel. May you have standing in Ephrathah and be famous in Bethlehem." And so there you go. Those are coming together right there. And so Bethlehem, Ephrathah, they're the same place, the same location. So that's what is being said. That's the place that we're talking about right here. I'm sure you knew this or are familiar with this. I'm just pointing it out. So it says, "But you, O Bethlehem Ephrathah, who are too little to be among the clans of Judah." It's a small town. Bethlehem was a small town. Ephrathah is a small town. But compared to Jerusalem, now you've got Jerusalem, the great city with the great king. But just 2 miles from there is Ephrathah or Bethlehem, a small town. Here's the great city. From Ephrathah, of course, that's where David came from. We're building on the line of David. Who are too little to be among the clans of Judah. It's not identified as its own place. In fact, it's got to be within a clan. It's not, here's Judah. Then you've got the clans. Ephrathah isn't even its own clan. It's got to be within the clan. It doesn't even stand out as something special. "From you shall come forth for me." And there's the phrases, "come forth," and later on, just the next line there, it says, "coming forth." And that's where we get this. They're coming forth, which means this, obviously, coming refers to the future. Micah will not see this person. It's not someone who's going to come deliver them in Micah's day. 701 B.C. is going to come and go, but they're still going to be waiting for this coming in the future. One is going to come from Ephrathah for me, who is to be the ruler in Israel. Now, again, the phrase "for me," this is God speaking. This ruler is going to come in the future for me. And that is an indication that when he comes, he's going to come to do God's will. He's being sent with a purpose. It's going to be to finalize the plan. For me, one who will be ruler in Israel. And there it is. He's going to be the ruler. He's going to be the king. But whose comings are, you can see right here, whose coming forth is from of old. He's coming from where? He's coming from these two words, old, and whose coming forth is from old, from ancient days. And on your notes, you've got those two words. He's coming in the future. He'll be ruler for the Lord. It's sometimes not in Micah's day, but he's coming from of old and ancient days. First of all, I'm turning over the page, and there's your two words. Number 7. The statement saying this ruler is coming from of old and from ancient days are terms which can indicate a time, two things, of great antiquity, but also mean eternal time past. So, and it says, like it says, the reference is determined by the context. So this ruler could be from the ancient, Israel's ancient past, like David. It could be David. But let's say it is, meaning this is not a new ruler. This is a ruler who's coming from the past. So no matter who this ruler is, the way Micah is writing this, this is unique. This is not going to be a descendant of David, although he will be. This is not going to be some great king that will arise like Alexander the Great. This is a ruler who's coming for the Lord, who is coming from old times, the ancient days. So if he's existing back here, so it could be David or someone like David. It could be anybody per se. But, you know, we stay within reasonable here of the Davidic promises. if it's David and David's going to arise and be this ruler, it's like, wow, that's pretty unique. That's supernatural. David lived his life, he died, and now he's going to come back. So it could be someone from the old days of Israel. But the fact that this means ancient day, well, here you can see right here. The word old, actually this is the word we're looking at. The word old, you can see it there, it's quadem. In Deuteronomy and Habakkuk, the verses are written out, not written, but the references are there. Old refers to God himself. God is quadem, which means eternal. Isaiah 37 and Lamentations 2 refers to God's purpose. God's purpose didn't just develop somewhere during time. God's purpose goes back to before time began. Isaiah 45 and 46 refer to God's declaration, God's decrees. Before God began anything, he made decrees. He established his purpose, declared decrees, and he's existing in eternity past. Psalm 68:33 refers to the heavens, eternity past. And then, of course, Proverbs 8:22-23, you're familiar with those verses, refer to a time before creation. So, this word old is used consistently of not the old days of David or the old days of the judges like Samson or the old days of Abraham. We're talking about the days before creation. This is time before time. So coming for me, coming in the future for me, who will be a ruler, who's coming from, in this case, time before time began. And, of course, that can only be one person. That's not going to be David. Now, the other word, ancient times, yami olam, in Micah 7, 14 and 20, it does mean Israel's earliest history. You know, for example, days of antiquity, you know, like David's day. But the use here in reference to a king who is yet to appear seems to also give this a supernatural element. So even if this ancient days means whose origins are of ancient days, like back in the days of Abraham or Noah or David, that's where he came from. It's like, my gosh, how old is he? And so even this, which can mean Israel's ancient history, means this ruler is supernatural. But this other word, old, refers to time before time. And so, I mean, I'm not telling you anything you don't know. I'm just explaining this verse to you so that every time those lousy progressive churches have their little Christmas service and candlelight services and they read this verse and they water it down so it means nothing, that you know this is talking about some supernatural appearance of a ruler in the future who's coming for God himself from ancient days that are before time began. And the worst you can do with this word, is that they are Israel's ancient history, but it's still going to be supernatural. That whoever this is, it's God himself. God himself is going to be coming for himself. If you say the Lord is speaking here, then the Lord is coming for me to be the ruler from my own time. I'm going to come fix this. The ruler in Micah's day, they're losers. And of course, that's not even being critical. You can say, like we talked last night about morals. We talked about things being established. There's going to be this absolute good or the absolute love. There has to be absolute morals. Now, underneath that, we're all living somewhere. This is where you see the fluctuation. There is the absolute good, and I might be good or better or worse than somebody else or myself. But in this world right here, this ancient day, this person's coming, and he's going to establish his rule. It's going to be coming for God's absolute rule is going to be the Lord. Now, in Micah's day, as in any time period, some man is going to be ruling for God. Maybe it's a guy like David. He's going to be a man after God's own heart, but yet he had to get disciplined. And maybe a guy like Saul, who himself was failed. Maybe it's Hezekiah, who's a pretty good king, but he's still not going to be able to pull this off. Anybody who comes during history to rule for God is going to fail. I mean, we fail. We're human. There's no one going to rise up and conquer the cosmos. But one day, coming for the Lord will be the Lord Himself, and that's the only way the Lord's purpose is going to be established. In the meantime, we're just holding ground, looking at the absolute standard of God, the goodness, the love, His righteousness, His justice, trying to attain it, sometimes closer, sometimes further away. But we're never going to get the kingdom of God. We're never going to get true justice until the true Lord comes to establish for Himself His own character in this earth. And so, nonetheless, it says in chapter 5, verse 2, I'll read it again. But you, O Bethlehem Ephrathah, who are too little to be among the clans of Judah, from you shall come forth for me, one who is the ruler in Israel, whose coming forth is from of old, from ancient days. Meaning, again, like I said, God is going to come Himself. Now, if you look at point C under point number 7, Isaiah 9:6. Remember, Isaiah and Micah are talking at the same time. Micah, or Isaiah 9:6, anticipated the future king would be called El. He will be called this. Isaiah is going to be saying so many similar things. It's just that he's going to have a lot longer book to say them in. But he talks about this coming ruler. Not only does he call him Prince of Peace, we'll get to that here in a moment. He's going to say this Prince of Peace is going to be El. And in Hebrew, this El is only speaking about the Lord or God, the God Himself. And so Isaiah says this ruler is going to be God, which, of course, does not surprise us because we know the doctrines. Chapter 5, verse 3. Here, see that first word, therefore. Because of chapter 5, verse 2. Because the ruler is coming for God from before time to Bethlehem at some point in history in the future. Because this is going to happen, therefore, this is going to be the results. When that happens, therefore, verse 3. Therefore, he shall give them up until the time when she who is in labor has given birth. That's not a positive verse for Micah's day. Because this king is coming in the future, this king whose origin is of old, from before time began, he's going to come in the future and he will establish God's plan. Therefore, until that happens, God is going to give them up until the time when she who is in labor has given birth. In other words, what's going to happen between Micah's day and this coming of the king? What's going to happen to Israel? I'm giving them up. I'm giving them up. And if you understand this, this ultimately had to be fulfilled in 586. 701 was a close call. Sennacherib was at the gates. There was some, God intervened with 185,000 Assyrians dying. We can read that story. It's recorded in history, in the Bible. It's recorded in the manuscripts, the seal, the scroll, the prisms. So this event took place. And then in 586, Jerusalem was totally destroyed and burned, and they were taken into Babylonian captivity. That's recorded in the Babylonian Chronicles. It's recorded in archaeology. It's recorded in the Scriptures. This takes place. It was at this time, for example, the Ark of the Covenant was lost. 701, they had to extend a lot of gold and tribute, but the Ark maintained its... I'm just using this as an example. This is not a big deal. But the Ark did not disappear until 586. That is when they disappeared. Now, they came back from captivity just to rebuild so that the Messiah could be born, pay for the sins of the world, so that Jerusalem could go back to where they came. God gave them up to the Roman Empire, and they were dispersed again. The Ark has not been seen since 586. The next time the Ark is going to be seen is going to be in the future. If you want to talk about the physical Ark itself, possibly, or at least in Revelation, it indicates the Ark was open and could, or the temple was open in heaven, and the earth can see into the temple in heaven, and they could see the Ark. Now, you decide what you want to think about the Ark, but there is going to be some kind of manifestation of something Ark-like in the future. I like to think they're going to actually find the Ark, but that's just Indiana Jones. It's type stuff. And again, you can talk about that. My point being, this verse is saying the same thing. It says in the English Standard Version, page 2, because this king is coming in the future and he's going to establish himself between the time that you're going to lose the ark and the time the Messiah returns, God is going to give them up. Israel is going to be given up by God. Now, that's exactly what we see in the Old Testament. That's exactly what Paul talks about. They're going to be given up. And so we see right here, chapter 5, verse 3, therefore, he shall give them up, Israel, until the time when she who is in labor has given birth. Then the rest of his brothers shall return to the people of Israel. Okay, point one is what I just said. Point two, since God is sending a God king in the future, Israel's defeat in Micah's day will only be temporary, but it's going to be long. Israel will face a time of total abandonment by God, and those are all the verses you can see in Micah 1:5, 2:1. Hosea, who wrote before and during Micah's time, is going to say the same thing in Hosea 1:9 and 3:4 through 5. We'll go to Hosea after this book. He calls, where God calls the people of Israel, he calls them, you can see it right here, Lo Ami, which means not my people. Now, Paul picks this up also when he talks in Romans about those who are called his people are now called not my people. Paul reverses it. Those who are not called my people are now called the people of God, which really strikes a blow against the whole Calvinistic message. But nonetheless, until the remnant returned and sought the king. So Hosea is saying the same thing. You're not going to be my people until you return and seek David, referring to the Messiah. Now, we've got a woman in labor here. They're going to be given up. The people of Israel are going to be given up until she who is in birth, she who is in labor, has given birth. Now, here's some options. First of all, she has to be someone who has already appeared in the text, because you can't just throw she in there. Who's she? It's got to be something in the context of Micah. So the idea that she is Mary giving birth to the Messiah is not a good option. It's not even linguistically possible. Spiritually, you can do anything. Once you become spiritual, you can become anybody you want it to be. But she has to be somebody. Point B, Micah 4, 9, and 10. I'm going to read it right now to you. We read it last week. Micah 4, 9, and 10. He's talking about Israel and the oppression coming on Jerusalem. Verse 9 says, why do you now cry aloud? Have you no king? Remember, they're being mocked. You're in your city crying. What, you have no king? Yeah, you've got a king, but you're acting like you don't have a king. Why doesn't your king stand up and do something? Because he's powerless. Has your counselor perished, that pain seizes you like that of a woman in labor? Writhe in agony, O daughter of Zion, like a woman in labor. For now you must leave the city to camp in the open field, which I said that was, you're leaving the city, not to go camping, but you're leaving the city to set up camp outside because you're going to be preparing for a death march to Babylon. You're camping out because your houses are burnt down. You've been taken captive. Now you're camping outside the city. To camp in the open field, you will go to Babylon. There you will be rescued. There the Lord will redeem you out of the hand of your enemies. It's exactly the same thing. They're in a panic. They're crying out. They're in agony. They're getting ready to give birth. It's not going to happen. You're going into exile. You're going into exile. You're going to stay there until the Lord is ready to rescue you. And then this labor, this pain will be over. So you can think about this birth being the birth of a child, a person like the Messiah. That's possible if you want to try this whole thing together with the Christmas story. Or you can think of this being she is Israel, and God is using Israel to produce the kingdom, to produce his will in the world. And Israel, because they've been chosen as an instrument, God is going to deal with them first. He's going to punish them. He's going to correct them. He's going to redeem them. They are, in a sense, in labor. Their whole history is, in a sense, of being in labor, getting ready to give birth to something that is not just a child. Now watch. I think I can find it real quickly here. This helps explain this play. Go to Revelation 13. And I've taught this before, and I wasn't planning on doing this, but it just seems obvious right now at this moment. Revelation 12. And you know this verse. Here it is. And I don't really, what time is it getting to be? Okay. Here we go. Chapter 12. This chapter 12 of Revelation, I do not think is a particular time in the tribulation. I don't think it's a particular event in history. I think it's an overview of history itself. And it plays into this. Israel has been given the promise. Israel's been given the word. Israel now is going to have to produce this, but there's going to be people coming against the promise. Because Israel is chosen, there are forces, not just Israel's sin. Now watch this. This is just not about Israel sinning and being rebellious. There are forces who are coming against Israel, just like the serpent came against Eve in the garden. There was a promise, there was a command, and he came and tried to destroy the word. Did God really say? And so there was an attack. There's an attack on this whole thing. And that is part of the plan. The attack is going to be a time of labor, of pain, of struggling. We're all part of it. But this is in Israel's idea. Here it is. Chapter 12, verse 1. A great and wondrous sign appeared in the heaven. A woman clothed with the sun and the moon under her feet and a crown of 12 stars on her head. She was pregnant, cried out in pain as she was about to give birth. Now that, I think, is no doubt Israel because of all the images there. Those are all images of Israel. And Israel was given the promise going way back to Abram's day. It wasn't because Abram was a great guy or Isaac was a great guy or Jacob. God stuck them with a promise. It's Israel was in the wilderness in Egypt. They came out. They've got this. Now also, here's the problem. Then another sign appeared in the heaven. God, one of the signs is there's a promise. Israel's been given a promise. But another sign appeared in the heavens. An enormous red dragon. It's not Israel's sin. It's Satan with 7 heads and 10 horns. Now, the 7 heads are going to be the 7 empires that have ruled during Israel's time. Egypt, Assyria, Babylon, Persia, Greece, Rome, and then the Antichrist kingdom. And the 10 horns and the 7 crowns. And the 10 horns are the 10 kings that come together. The 7 crowns are the powers of the empires on his head. That, now, all of those are of the cosmos. Satan is the god of this age. From the cosmos of this age is coming against the promise. His tail swept a third of the stars out of the sky and flung them to the earth. Now, my friends, that verse is where theology gets the idea that a third of the angels rebelled with Satan. That's it. That's you. And I've said that before when we went through theology. But it says, his tail swept a third of the stars out of the sky. From that verse, they build the doctrine, and I'm not disagreeing with it. I'm just saying, where's that verse in the Bible that says when Satan tempted the angels, he misled a third of the angels, and they were kicked out of heaven? This is the verse right here. Okay. And flung them to the earth. Okay, there it is. The dragon stood in front of the woman who was about to give birth so that he might devour her child the moment it was born. She gave birth to a son, a male child, who will rule all the nations with an iron scepter. Now, there's the birth of a child who is going to come to fulfill God's promise. So, Israel is going to give birth. They're in labor. They're going to give birth. In this case, they're giving birth to a child, which would be Jesus, who will eventually rule the world. Now, it says, who will rule the nations with an iron scepter. And her child was snatched up to God and to his throne. So I think we're going to assume there that Israel, or Mary, in Israel, gave birth to the Messiah, who is not going to establish his kingdom. Instead, he's going to do a different work, which is dying on the cross, and then is resurrected, snatched up to heaven, to God, and to his throne. And Jesus sat at the right hand of God. Now, back on earth, the woman fled into the desert to a place prepared for her by God, where she might be taken care of for 1,260 days. And that 1,200, that's the people of God, that's 1,260 days, as you know, it's 3.5 years. It's half of the 7-year tribulation, if you want to read it that way. And now this thing is playing out. See, we're rushing through the whole history of this. Jesus is born. He's been taken to heaven. Now we're waiting for his return. And Israel's going to be at some point when they come back to him in the wilderness, protected for 1,260 days. In the paper, not the paper, in the news today, it was on Fox, and I saw it somewhere else, put it on my Facebook page. You know where Mount Sinai is traditionally. Now, again, check this out. Wait and see if it's correct. You can't believe anything in the news. I mean, even Fox. Even anything in the news. Even my Facebook posts. Check them out. Okay, so here is Mount Sinai. Here's the Gulf of Aqaba. Here's the Red Sea going down like this. Here's Egypt over here. Here's Mount Sinai here. Here's the land of Midian. This is where Moses fled to. He flees to the land of Midian. You know this. This is the traditional sound of Mount Sinai. It's never good. It's never made sense. It was established as the site of Mount Sinai, like in Constantine's day. Some monk went out there, built a monastery, and that's where everybody says it took place. Archaeologists have gone over this whole area. There's no evidence of anybody ever having lived there, traveled there, especially, you know, for 40 years. There's no sign. That doesn't mean it's not true, but it's like, and this is where Moses went up and looked at it. Fine. I've never liked that. It doesn't make sense. In my 2008 book, Framework, again, it wasn't me. I didn't go there, but I'd read some things. Over here in the land, in Saudi Arabia, over here, is what appears to be the true Mount Sinai. Over here, and you can do some research on it, and there's been no videos come out of there. There's been some pictures. But there's Egyptian writing. There's carvings of Egyptian cattle the way on things. There's stones that are set up like pillars that are set. Again, this is what I've read over the years. Even Biblical Archaeology did an article about this place saying there's three locations for Mount Sinai. The traditional one, someplace here in the Negev in southern Judah, was a high place. It's been a holy site for years. I mean, going back to the Chalcolithic times, there's a little mound there that they used. That could be it. And then they actually finally, like 2 years ago, put this and said, this could be it. Now, in the news today, if it's true, Saudi Arabia, and you've seen them become very friendly to the Jews. They've even supported the Jews in different cases. They have some kind of ideal of there's been some talk about Christianity. Women are starting to drive, which doesn't mean Jesus is coming back. It just means that's not normal. They're doing things different. And now they've had this place walled off. They're now talking about opening it up to get some tourism in there from the Christian community. And you can read the article, see what, and I'm telling you, and you can read it, see what, that's where I got my information. If I'm wrong, I got it from that article. You can make your own corrections. But that's interesting. Now, that makes sense because, remember, when Paul writes in Galatians, he talks about Jerusalem being the free woman and Sinai being the slave woman, which is Mount Sinai, which he says is in Arabia, which is over here, Arabia. Moses was in Midian. Paul talked about Arabia. Paul, Elijah, then when he fled, went down to this place, not this place. Paul, when he was gone for 3 years in Arabia, would have gone to this place. This is probably the most likely place, just like they've just now recently discovered where the actual location of Sodom is. This may be, the reason I'm telling you this is this lines up with Daniel and Jesus' revelation. Because Daniel and Jesus says, when you see the abomination, flee and go to Moab, Edom, Ammon, go down into here. Go here. The 144,000 are going to be hidden away. Jesus is going to come back into this territory here, maybe, and this is where the 144,000 are going to be kept. So somehow, and I've been talking about it for years, since the 80s, I've been talking about, again, not that anything, but it doesn't make sense that here's Galilee, Jordan, the Dead Sea, here's Jerusalem. The Jews are in Jerusalem when the Antichrist appears and they realize that he's broken the treaty. They're supposed to flee down here into Saudi Arabia. It's like, well, really, where else are they going to flee from? I mean, where are you going to flee on foot? I mean, you can't. They're surrounded by Muslims. But it's interesting that over the years we've been seeing Saudi Arabia in this area starting to be friendlier, more accommodating. And just keep watching that, because it's had that. They've actually, along with Jordan, they built a wall up here. You knew this, right? There's a wall up in here going across northern Jordan, Saudi Arabia these days, to keep ISIS out. They're building a wall. They've got to come way out and survive in the desert. So anyway, that's way off subject, but it's interesting because of chapter 12 tying into what I'm talking about here tonight. I'm going back to Micah to finish this up. We are almost out of time. Okay, chapter 5, verse 3. Therefore, because the Messiah is coming from the ancient times, sometime in the future, to establish his kingdom, therefore, because that's when he's coming back, he, the Lord, shall give them up, Israel, until the time when she who is in labor has given birth. And who is in labor? In the context of the book of Micah, Jerusalem is in labor. Jerusalem is the capital of Judah, or Israel. So Israel, once again, is in labor. And they are going to give birth to the Messiah. They're going to give birth to the fulfillment of the kingdom of God. And they're going to be cast off until they're going to be in labor, until it's time for them to give birth to what God planned for them. So this is, I think, when it talks about she who is in labor has given birth, it's Israel. And when she has given birth, it says, then the rest of his brothers shall return to the people of Israel, and Israel will be regathered. And there I've got some things written down right there. The future day includes, here's point five, the future day includes not just the coming of the Messiah, but the return of his brothers to the people of Israel. Zechariah 10:10 says, I will bring them home from the land of Egypt and gather them from Assyria, and I will bring them to the land of Gilead and to Lebanon till there is no room for them. I mean, he's going to fill up the land. Isaiah 11, again being written at the same time as Micah. In that day, the Lord will reach out his hand a second time to reclaim the surviving remnant of his people from Assyria, Lower Egypt, Upper Egypt, Cush, Elam, Babylonia, Hamath, from the islands of the Mediterranean, that's the Western world. He will raise a banner for the nations and gather the exiles of Israel. He will assemble the scattered people of Judah from the four quarters of the earth. That's talking about the same time period. So you've got Zechariah, you've got Micah, you've got Isaiah talking about this return. When she gives birth to the plan of God, and the Messiah shows up, and this is basic theology. Verse 6. In this line of thinking, the actual captivity would continue until the Messiah came. And this lines up with the loss and return of the Ark of the Covenant. I try to explain that. Chapter 5, verse 4. When they're all gathered back together, and he shall stand and shepherd his flock in the strength of the Lord, in the majesty of the name of the Lord his God. So that is now the king, typical king shepherd illustration. He's going to come back and he's going to shepherd his people as the king. And he's going to shepherd them in the strength of the Lord, in the majesty of the name of the Lord his God. Two things, in the strength of the Lord, in the name of the Lord. And they shall dwell secure, for now he shall be great to the ends of the earth. They're not going to dwell secure until this happens. So Israel's being told, you're going into captivity and there's nothing you can do about it because your king is not here. You can't have security until this happens. In fact, God is going to give you up until this takes place. And then look at chapter 5, verse 5, the very first part. And he shall be their peace. And that is again, chapter 5, the first verse, the end of this section. Because as soon as you go to the next line, it talks about when the Assyrian invades. It goes back to talking about 701. You probably got that break in your text of your Bible. This section ends with chapter 5, verse 1, and he shall be their peace. There's maybe a break. And then, when the Assyrian invades, goes back to 701 or the days of Hezekiah or of Micah. I do want to point this out. And he, that's the Messiah, Messiah will be their peace. He is not going to be the peacemaker. He is going to be the peace. And this is typical of absolutes. This is typical of Jesus. Jesus, like we said last night, Jesus isn't going to give you life. Jesus is life. Jesus is not going to be good. Jesus is good. He is light. He is truth. He, here it is. Messiah, well, I'll read it in the text here. And he shall be their peace. He's not going to provide them peace or give them peace. He's going to be their peace. These are absolutes. The very fact it's written like this are absolutes that this can only come from. It's not going to say David will be their peace. David would have to provide them with peace. David would have to create peace. He would have to be their peacemaker. He would have to use war, or he'd have to use negotiation and treaties or something to create peace. Messiah is going to be peace. Now, again, I think he'll use war. He'll use everything, all the avenues, but he is peace himself. And that, again, is another divine character trait of this individual Micah is talking about. All right. Very last thing right there, Isaiah 9:6. He's going to be called the Prince of Peace. So, again, Micah and Isaiah are on the same page, especially since they are at the same time period. I'll pray, and you're free to go. We'll try to work through the rest of the chapter next week. Father, we thank you for the chance to look into your word. We thank you for the promises we see here. We do ask that these things would not just be information, but things that would inspire us, encourage us, transform us, that we may again be the people you want us to be at this time in history. We pray for revival in our land and revival in our churches. In Jesus' name, amen. Thank you for your time.